Chair notes that we do have the presence of a quorum, so we'll take up the minutes from the meeting. February 10, 2005, they are in the packet. Representative Newman moves approval. Any discussion on that motion? If not, those in favor signify by saying aye. Those opposed, no. Motion prevails. The minutes are adopted. Committee, we have four bills before us today. Some may move, depending on the motion, be moved. Others may be moved to be held for possible inclusion in our omnibus bill. The first bill before us is House File 483, Representative Knobloch, the issue of trespass law expanded relating to crime of return to private or school property. Chair moves the bill. It's before us. Go ahead. And Representative Knobloch, we do have four bills. We will take our time with each one, but we'll see what we can do in about 20 minutes on each bill, if you can help us out. Representative Knobloch, go ahead.
Well, Mr. Chairman, members, thank you for the opportunity to continue to consider House File 483. This bill passed this committee last year. I don't know how many members remember it, but it was a fairly non-controversial bill last year. I went to the General Register, but then didn't make it through the process in the end. House File 483, as I hope to have it amended, basically does two things. First, it amends the trespass statute in regard to the time, so that instead of having a 30-day trespass issue where a person can come back after being told to leave a property after 30 days, it would be amended to be 1 year. Believe it or not, there are actually people that come back every 30 days after being told to leave a property, 30 days on the dot, 30 days month after month after month, and it just is a real hindrance to businesses, and it seems like 1 year would be a more suitable standard. Secondly, we have an amendment that would apply the trespass statute to aggregate mining companies too, as well as construction sites. And Mr. Chair, I have three witnesses here. Mr. Chair, I guess I would be at your pleasure as to whether you would like to move the A1 and A2 amendment to get the bill into the shape that I would like it to be before the committee.
All right, at this point, any questions? Okay, we do have a number of witnesses.
Mr. Chair, do you want to take the amendments first, or should I take the witnesses?
Let's go with your amendments to get the bill in the shape you like.
Okay, I appreciate it. Mr. Chair, if someone could move the A1 amendment, what the A1 amendment does is...
Chair moves the A1 amendment. Go ahead.
Okay, as the bill was originally drafted, it set an indefinite time standard at any time once someone was kicked off the property, and I... upon further reflection, think that's too much. I think that we should have it be 1 year. And so this would have the trespass statute move from 30 days to 1 year.
Okay. Any questions on that amendment? If not, all those in favor on that motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no.
Mr. Chair, the second amendment is the A2 amendment. And what the A2 amendment does, Mr. Chair, is right now we have construction sites included in the statute specifically in regard to the trespassing statute. This would also make it specific to aggregate mining companies, aggregate mining sites, which frankly in many ways seems like the same thing.
All right. That's an author's amendment. Chair would move the A2 amendment. Any discussion? If not, do you have it?
Yes.
Any discussion? Representative Murphy.
Does that mean that they're looking for agates too?
Well, I think maybe I should call down Mr. Ewald, representing the aggregate mining companies, to maybe answer more of the specifics of how this has been a problem for them.
Sir, have a seat. Give us your name and then respond to that question.
Mr. Chair, members, I'm David Ewald. I'm here representing the Aggregate and Ready Mix Association of Minnesota. Basically, this is an issue that results from trespassers in an aggregate mining facility or gravel pit, as Representative Murphy indicated. riding ATVs or things like that in already mined aggregate piles. And actually, the kind of aggregate that's being pulled out is aggregate that's used in concrete and wouldn't be really suitable, like agate material. But it is a serious problem with the both the safety issue and disrupting the piles that have already been mined and segregated.
Representative Murphy.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Ewald, but most ag hunters aren't riding four wheels. Most of them are walking with their little pails.
Mr. Chair and Representative Murphy, I wouldn't disagree with you. I think the bulk of the problem is a more serious issue related to people that are actually doing what we would call trespassing in the facility, though, and putting themselves at risk and also mixing up these piles. That's why the amendment.
Who else had a question? Representative Ellison.
Mr. Chair, Representative Knobloch gentlemen, I'm sorry I didn't catch your name.
David Ewald.
Mr. Ewald, is there any implication here for legitimate First Amendment activity? For example, I perfectly understand a storekeeper or anybody like that saying that somebody's a nuisance, you can't come back for a year. And I'm not really too opposed to it, but I am concerned about, for example, somebody were engaging in legitimate protest activity and then could be trespassed for an extended period of time, such as a year. Is any event like that sort of the inspiration for this bill, or is the origin of this bill simply another matter?
Mr. Chair, Representative Ellison. Well, I guess that's a little bit different than the A2 amendment before us, but no, that's not the impetus of this bill, and I'll have some other witnesses who in a minute can testify to that issue.
Mr. Chair, well, I guess, you know, a gravel pit is, I just was wondering, were there protests at the gravel pit? Were there some sort of environmental concerns that occurred at the gravel pit that inspired this amendment or not?
Well, Mr. Chair, I guess Mr. Ewald can talk too, but Representative Ellison, it's my understanding that the concern is that when they're mining the gravel and segregating it into the different grades, the biggest problem is they've got off-highway vehicles that are going into the pit, driving over the gravel, mixing it together. It's a dangerous situation for people who are driving the OHVs, ATVs. It's a costly problem for the aggregate mines as well. And certainly people could, you know, if they wanted to protest, they can certainly, it's probably, the protest issue is probably more one for the rest of the bill in terms of retail stores and such. If someone's got a protest issue, they could stand outside the gates of the aggregate mining company on public property and hold their protest signs.
Any other questions for Mr. Ewald? Representative Eastland.
On that issue, the way that inserts in there, it says, it talks about enters a locked or posted construction site or aggregate mining site. Is there a posting requirement for the aggregate mining site too?
Mr. Chair.
Is that assumed to be understood here, or are we just saying that somebody could actually not know that that's what this is, and they're not aware of this law, and they're out riding their ATV, and they're going up, and they're breaking some law, and they didn't have the ability to know that they were where they shouldn't be.
Mr. Chair and Representative Eastland, to the best of my knowledge, an aggregate mining site is pretty discernible that it's identified as such. But I'd have to check for an official answer on that as to what if there's a requirement or what. But I think it's pretty easy to tell.
Should there be a posting? I guess that's my question. If it's a construction site, that's obvious. Mm. But we're requiring that to be posted. But we're not requiring the aggregate mining site to be posted here, I guess. Is that something that we should be thinking about making consistent, or?
Mr. Chair, I think at this time what I'd like to do is have you temporarily lay over this amendment. Mr. Ewald's going to see if he can get an answer to that. And we've got some other witnesses on the bill in general, and we can, in the interest of time for the committee, start bringing them forward.
That'd be fine. Chair, lay that amendment on the table.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. First witness I'd have would be Rob Allen with the Minneapolis Police Department.
Morning.
Morning, Mr. Chair.
Want to give us your name and go ahead?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Inspector Rob Allen with the Minneapolis Police Department. I'm the commander of the 1st Precinct, which is downtown Minneapolis. And I just want to lay out the problem for you. With the 30-day trespass tool available for businesses downtown, the problem that's frequently run into is businesses trespass people for 30 days who are caught stealing in their stores or committing some other disorderly crime. And before the case is even adjudicated, the person's allowed back into the store. So we can't, as conditions of release or conditioning of the sentence, bar the person from entering the store because the case hasn't been adjudicated. And so every 30 days, store owners, and there are people, strange as it may seem, who sort of tick off the 30 days, they know their trespass warrants, and they know when they can go back into the store. And it's become a chronic problem. Trespassing is a very useful tool for businesses because it prevents other crimes from occurring. If people are trespassed from the stores after being caught stealing, they don't have an opportunity to steal from the store again. And the stores don't have to sit and wait for the person to steal again and arrest them for stealing. They can bar them from entering the store. Other piece of that is that it allows property owners the ability to prevent or reduce the incidence of livability crimes, such as disorderly conduct, public urination, and loitering with the intent to buy or sell narcotics, by having an enforcement mechanism where people who are engaged in those activities can leave the stores. So those are sort of the general highlights of our interest in this.
Any questions of the inspector? Representative Ellison.
Good to see you, Commander Allen. Do you recall a few years ago with Carson Perry Scott and a few other downtown retailers were having a series of very unpleasant experiences with black shoppers? In fact, black shoppers got so incensed that they started wearing buttons, "I am not a shoplifter." Remember that? Because there was such a series of recurrent events and of African-American shoppers being approached by shopkeepers when they really weren't doing anything at all. I guess this does make me a little worried that you know, that how this might be used. I think if it was applied properly, it'd be no problem. But if it isn't, and we know people don't always behave properly, it could be a real problem. Do you have any thoughts on this subject?
Mr. Chair, Representative Ellison, the comment I have for that is that, you know, the department has been involved, the Minneapolis Police Department has been involved in situations where, in the past, they have abetted a business in discriminatory action. And as a result, the department was held liable for that behavior. As a result, one of the essential pieces of information that officers are required to obtain when they're dealing with a trespassing situation is to ensure that it's not arbitrary, it's not capricious, that there's a legitimate interest in barring the person from the business. And that's standard practice now. I agree that it's been a problem in the past, but I think that both businesses, you know, businesses are in the business to have people come into their businesses, and they're you know, trying not to exclude most people because they want people to shop in the business, and they want to make money. I think that on the business end, this problem is taken care of out of economic interest for the businesses. But I think on the police end, because it's been made very clear to us by the courts that we are not to abet a business in any kind of discriminatory action, that we have the policies in place that will prevent that from happening.
Any other questions, Mr. Inspector Allen? Representative Murphy?
Mr. Chair, Representative Knobloch, Officer Alan, in light of Amendment A1, could the shop owner or the store owner or the school principal or the superintendent or whoever make a lesser time for an individual?
Inspector Allen.
Mr. Chair, Representative Murphy, my understanding is that the time is up to the store owner. It doesn't require 1 year. It's permissive. A store owner doesn't have to trespass anybody or somebody at all. They have that option, and then they can fill in the blank for what that time period is.
So it's up to a year, or it's a year unless they say for 6 months.
Mr. Chair, Representative Murphy, actually the trespassing form that most people use put the date right on. You are, you know, not to enter this property until such and such a date. And they can put currently whatever date up to 30 days. And my understanding is with a law change, it would be for any period up to 1 year.
Do you foresee that they might still use 30 days in many cases?
Inspector Allen.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Representative Murphy, that would be up to the business. I would imagine if it was, you know, in some case where they still want the person's business, it's a one-day thing, I would see cases where businesses might be willing to do that.
Representative
Knoblock,
how about school district?
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative Murphy, I guess I think it is kind of a case-by-case situation. My suspicion would be that if it's a one-time occurrence with someone, it wouldn't necessarily be 1 year. If it becomes a chronic problem where someone has been coming back every 30 days, I suspect then they would go with the 1 year.
Any other questions? Any other testimony?
Yes, Mr. Chair. I have two other witnesses. I'll try to be as brief as we can. I have Matt Larson from St. Cloud with the Coburn's Grocery Stores.
Mr. Larson, come on down.
Morning. Give us your name and then proceed with your testimony.
Mr. Chair, my name is Matthew Larson. I'm Director of Loss Prevention for Coburn's Incorporated. We have, with our shoplift apprehension program, we have seen numerous times where we're dealing with repeat offenders, and at the current time we have an extreme difficulty trying to keep these people out. They understand that the law only allows us to enforce a trespass for 30 days, and you know, as said earlier, that 31st day they're back. We have actually had contacts with some people as many as almost 24 times, and there have been a number of situations like that. And we're looking for a tool to help it more cost-effective for us to deal with these situations, because it takes a lot of labor to deal with them. Of course, if we're seeing someone in there a couple dozen times, they're probably in there 100 times, and we're only picking them out a couple dozen times.
Question. Thank you.
Thank you. My last testifier is Jessica Didominas with the Marshall Fields department store chain.
Good morning.
Morning.
Again, these changes would benefit us as business owners.
Excuse me, for the record, just repeat your name.
My name is Jessica Didominas. I'm representing Marshall Field Stores.
Thank you.
Thank you. Again, this would benefit us as business owners, keeping these chronic offenders of not only theft but business disruptions out of our buildings. We would like our customers to have a great shopping experience in our stores, and not have to be dealing with people who are panhandling, being disruptive in our buildings. This is a great tool for us to be able to utilize that to ensure that our guests are going to be safe in our buildings.
Any questions? Thank you.
Thank you.
Representative Knoblock, do you have anyone else?
No, that's it, Mr. Chair. Be prepared to answer any of the questions that anyone has.
Representative Paymar.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Knobloch, on Section 2 of the bill, the page 4 on E, I'm looking at the section that deals with the warrantless arrest. That language, correct me if I'm wrong, that looks like it's the from the old domestic abuse statute that said that if the offense happened within 4 hours, an arrest could be made as long as the officer had probable cause to believe that a crime had occurred. Does this deal specifically with the school districts, or is this for the entire bill?
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative Paymar, this is current law.
Is that?
I guess I haven't looked at it that closely, but I believe it just deals with school property.
Okay. Thank you.
All right.
Other questions? Did you want to revisit the amendment?
Mr. Chair, I think what I would prefer to do at this point. There's Mr. Ewald. All right. I guess with Mr. Ewald here, maybe I can ask if anyone has any other questions on the aggregate issue.
Okay, the A2 amendment then will be back before us. Did you have additional testimony on that amendment?
Mr. Chair, I'm sorry for taking the time of the committee on this. Did get an answer that they think it'd be fine to make it clear that under that that clause that it was locked or posted construction site or locked or posted aggregate site. So it read essentially the same as you were treating it with the construction site.
Representative Knobloch, do you want to tell us what he just told us?
I'm sorry, Mr. Chair.
Would you tell us again what he just told us?
Mr. Chair, it's my understanding that the intent would be that the amendment would only apply to locked and posted aggregate mining sites, just as the current language only applies to locked and posted construction sites.
Questions on that testimony? Anyone? Representative Nelson?
The way I read this here, it's locked or posted. Are you saying locked and posted?
I'm sorry, locked or posted.
Okay. Thank you.
Representative Knobloch, then you misspoke and it should be or instead of and in your explanation. Is that right?
That is correct, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Further questions?
Mr. Chair, I think what I would do is if you could amend the amendment to say page 3, line 8, after the word site, insert or locked or posted aggregate mining site.
Without objection, we'll make that a part of your a part of the amendment by incorporation.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right, then we have an amended A2 amendment before us. Discussion on that. If not, those in favor of the A2 amendment as amended, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. Motion prevails. House File 43 as amended. Representative Murphy.
Mr. Chair, Representative Knobloch. We've got stores and merchants. We've got schools, school districts. We've got construction sites. We've got gravel pits. We're not going to put railroads in here, are we, with railroad tracks?
Mr. Chair, Representative Murphy, I've seen that debate before, and no, that is not my intention.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Anything else? All, at your request, Representative Knobloch, the Chair is going to restate his motion and I would move that House File 43 be recommended to pass as amended. Any discussion on that amendment?
Well, would appreciate the member's support.
No discussion. Those in favor of the motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. Motion prevails and passes. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
Pardon?
All right, the next item on the agenda would be House File 382. Author Representative Hillstrom, non-vehicular flight from a peace officer prohibited and misdemeanor penalty imposed. Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Before you is House File 382. We have heard this bill.
Representative Hillstrom, do you want to move this? And it will be my intent to hold the other three bills that we're about to hear for possible inclusion in an omnibus bill later on. Do you want to move the bill so that it can be before us?
Certainly, Mr. Chair. I would move House File 382 be held over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
Very good. Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Before you, you have House File 382, which would once again reinstate language into state statute that was there prior to a change that we made in the past 2 years. I believe it was 2 years ago we made fleeing a police officer by automobile a felony. And when we did that, inadvertently, this language was taken out, which made the crime of fleeing a police officer by any other means a crime. And so with me today, I have Detective Terry Olson from the Brooklyn Center Police Department to speak on behalf of this bill.
Good morning. My name is Terry Olson. I've been a police officer since 1990 here in the state of Minnesota. I'm here today to offer brief testimony. I know you have other business to attend to. I'm here to express our interest in pursuing legislation that would criminalize the act of evading police on foot, on a bicycle, or by any means other than in a motor vehicle. Until recently, we were able to prosecute suspects who flee the police for a variety of reasons under the obstructing legal process statute. Recent case law, and when I say recent, I mean relatively recent case law over the course of the last 2 years, has made the application of that statute in that instance impossible. So at the current time, if a suspect flees an officer on foot, there's no criminal offense that we can prosecute them for. Fleeing offenders very often run because they are hoping to avoid arrest, hoping to avoid identification, or to dispose of evidence. And particularly in drug offenses, fleeing suspect will run just long enough to dispose of the drug evidence and essentially not face arrest for any criminal offense.
Any questions of Detective Olson? Thank you for your testimony.
Thank you.
Representative Hillstrom, who else?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Again, I would renew my motion that okay. House File 382 be held over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
Sounds like a good bill. Thank you. Further questions or discussion? If not, Chair, we'll lay the bill on the table for possible inclusion later on in the omnibus bill. House File 381, Representative Hillstrom.
That's it.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's my understanding that you were going to bring Representative Cornish to the table.
I was just going to ask, would you allow us to do that? All right, Representative Cornish, you have a bill as well, House File 618. Why don't you both have a seat?
Mr. Chair, if I might also request that Bill Gillespie and Chief Steve Johnson of the Rochester Police Department come forward.
Let's do that. Do we have? Can we bring some chairs up to the side so that we don't have to play musical chairs? Can you see if we can sit the gentleman to the side of each author? Okay. Go ahead.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm actually going to defer to Representative Cornish. I have carried this bill in the past, and Representative Cornish has a Senate author, and he's going to make his bill and my bill the same, and so I would just defer to him if that's the will of the chair.
Representative Cornish.
Thank you, Representative Hillstrom. Mr. Chair and members, this House File 618. Mr. Chairman, how do you want me to handle the author's delete all amendment? Do you want me to take that up first?
Okay, just give us
the E1 delete all.
First of all, move the bill, and then we got that before us.
Hey, Mr. Chairman and members, I'd like to move House File 618.
Okay.
Be held over for inclusion in the omnibus bill.
All right, it's before us now. Your amendment is styled what?
What's the number? Say again, Mr. Chair.
What is the number on the amendment?
The amendment to delete all is E1, Mr. Chair.
Okay, tell us the amendment.
The amendment, Mr. Chair, is a delete all to 618, and the basically it's a delete all amendment to put 618 in order of a, it's a false reporting to a police officer.
Let's go ahead and, for the record, the DE1 amendment is to get the bill in the shape that the author wants. If there's no discussion on that, those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. All right, we have 618 as amended before us. Now go ahead.
Mr. Chair and members, what this bill is it was brought to me by the Minnesota Police and Peace Officers Association. I'll be introducing the executive director here shortly. The bill was brought up at an annual convention and got the resounding support from the rank and file of the Minnesota Police and Peace Officers Association, and addresses a couple of subjects. One is providing false information to a police officer, and the other is false accusations concerning a police officer. After that short introduction, I'll turn it over to Bill Gillespie, the executive director of the Minnesota Police Officers Organization, who will get into a little further, with your permission.
Go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, first of all, I want to apologize for the necessity of going through the delete all process and jacking the wrong language. The language that you will have before you in the E1 amendment is the language which passed out of this committee last year after testimony. There were some agreements made with various folks about that language. We felt it was necessary to put this language back in to honor those agreements. The legislation contained in 618 is the response to two separate fact situations. The line two are about a police officer and the inability of prosecutors to apply sanctions against those who do either act. Two separate resolutions were submitted by the Rochester and Brooklyn Center police officers at the annual convention of the Minnesota Police and Peace Officers Association during the 2003 annual convention at Arrowwood, Minnesota. They were unanimously passed by the delegate body of 131 members of our organization. The resolution submitted by both Rochester and Brooklyn Center Police requested a change to the existing obstruction of legal process statute and was in response to the inability of prosecutors to file charges against persons who lied to police during a police investigation. This behavior causes the authorities to spend time and resources in disproving false claims, upsetting innocent persons who are needlessly dragged into police investigations, jeopardizes successful investigations and prosecutions in major cases such as murder, child abduction, rape, and leads to a disrespect for the will of the people to control deviant and unlawful behavior. The resolution submitted by the Rochester Police requested the creation of a new statute that would make the filing of a false complaint of misconduct by a police officer a crime and allow for the department to recover costs associated with the investigating complaints proven false. Subjects at times make completely false allegations against police law enforcement officers for reasons of retaliation, obstruction, or financial gain. Police and sheriff departments are forced to waste valuable resources to investigate such complaints, find the effect destructive to the morale of the officers and their families, and the confidence of the public they serve is eroded by the mere allegation of impropriety. Unfortunately, there is no consequence for the instigator of a lie shown clearly and convincingly to be untrue. There is no effective remedy in civil law for most of the time because the perpetrator is indigent and judgment-proof. They have nothing to lose and the officer nothing to gain in pursuing a case of civil tort against the offender. There is no effective remedy in criminal law because the statutes are silent on the matter. And although the harassment statute does provide subdivision that deals with false complaints against officers, the statute requires that the false complaint be made with the intent to influence or tamper with the officer's performance of their official duties. That language creates an issue of doubt for prosecutors who feel they cannot prove beyond a reasonable doubt that the complaint had any effect on the officer's duties. In formulating 618, the strategy of combining the two resolutions into a new, separate statute involving both issues was a response to the input of county and city attorneys who cautioned against tampering with the existing obstructing legal process language. They advised that the Minnesota Supreme Court takes the narrowest of interpretations of that language and that new language would be more likely to survive judicial review if it had clear legislative intent attached to the passage. Within that, I'll also add that this really became, the impetus for this really became in the Drew Shadeen matter with and the instigation of several incidents in Rochester and in, obviously, Minneapolis and Duluth, where there were allegations made which proven being true, and there were major investigations in which a great deal of time and police resources were wasted by people who offered misleading or false testimony. In concluding my remarks, I will indicate that this, as last year, has a very high level burden of proof. The threshold here is knowing and intentionally. And so, therefore, the random act of making a mistake or filing a false report against your spouse, believing that you had been abused, is not encumbered in here, because you have to knowingly and with the intent of misleading and the officer file such a report. With that, I would like to introduce Deputy Chief Steve Johnson of the Rochester Police Department.
Deputy Chief Johnson, good morning.
Good morning, Mr. Chair. I'm Deputy Chief Steve Johnson of the Rochester Police Department. I urge you to consider this matter seriously. It is a big burden on police officers and the departments, the communities they serve, when departments are required to refute false allegations of police misconduct. It does a lot of damage to the officer's family, the officer's partners, the community, the state, and even the profession when these allegations are allowed to go unchallenged. In my particular case, we investigated a false allegation of a federal civil rights violation. It was alleged that our officers beat a person for 20 minutes with PR-24 riot batons. We do not have PR-24 riot batons, and we established clearly and convincingly that those allegations were false, yet we were left without any legal remedy to help us fend that allegation off. So I would urge you to consider this matter seriously. Thank you.
Very good. Thank you, sir. Any questions of either gentleman? Representative Ellison, and then Eastland. Representative Ellison.
Mr. Chair, could you please articulate for me how many specific incidents we're talking about?
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Representative Ellison, I don't have an exact count on the number of incidences. For Rochester, I'd say probably a half a dozen or so over the past 2-3 years across the state. There is no centralized reporting. There is a central report that goes to the post board, but I'm not sure if they're collated along lines of false reports. They're sustained, unsustained, unfounded, those sorts of things. Sorry.
Representative Ellis.
Mr. Chair, how many allegations of police misconduct are in fact sustained, where police do engage in misconduct against citizens?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Ellison, I asked for those statistics in 2003 during the testimony of 2004. For Minneapolis, if I can remember correctly, it's been a while, I believe that there were 30 allegations in which there were proven to be false. The vast majority of them were unsustained, and at that time I think there were 7 proven allegations of police misconduct. In St. Paul, I believe in 2004, if I remember right, there were and I'm pulling this out of my hat, I remember that there were in excess of 200 unsustained police allegations. There were 17 or 18 allegations which were proven to be false, and there were 5 accounts of police misconduct that were sustained by either the Civilian Review Board or by the Police Internal Affairs.
Mr. Chair? Well, you know, under the Minneapolis Ordinance, which I helped to write and draft, there is no category for proven to be false. There is no such category as that, Mr. Gillespie. So could you please explain to me how you arrived at a statistical measure of 30 allegations which were proven to be false, since Minneapolis has no such category?
Those, Mr. Chairman, Representative Ellison, those were provided to me by the Office of Inspector Dolan.
Mr. Chair, did you confer with the Civilian Review Authority or the Civil Rights Department in Minneapolis?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Ellison, no.
Representative Ellis.
Did I believe Mr. Gillespie was answering the question.
I think he answered no.
Oh, okay. I didn't hear.
Mr. Chair?
All right.
If I could address that question.
Representative Cornish, go ahead.
As a conservation officer, I could tell you dozens. I could probably talk for a couple hours. As president of our union, we went through this many, many times. Just a real quick war story. Myself, having found a person stealing trees and cutting and stealing trees, the person made an accusation to our county attorney and the whole county attorney staff that I yelled at him, I berated him, that I made false accusations, that I almost gave his mother a heart attack. It undermined my credibility with the judge, with the county attorney, and everybody on the staff. Because he gave such a convincing argument and he was a well-respected member of the community. Very luckily for me, he did not know that I had a video camera in my truck on at the time, and it recorded most of every single bit of the conversation and half of it on video. So what I was able to do, luckily for me in that instance, was provide the video and show him to be a liar in the worst extent, and I was cleared. But if I wouldn't have, that's the problem that our officers are running into. Everybody from well-respected members of the community to the people that aren't are making these accusations, and it causes a lot of money to be spent both by the unions and by management in investigating and hiring special investigators to go through this long, drawn-out investigations of misconduct by police officers, and it's very unfortunate, and I think this will help a long way to going towards resolving that.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Ellison.
Well, I got a few war stories myself, Representative Cornish. I got so many war stories that in my district, we had to have a civilian/police mediation session because so many people report to me even now on a daily basis that the police beat them up, mistreat them, call them foul names, thing like that. And many allegations have been sustained. As Mr. Gillespie pointed out, he's aware of at least 7 allegations where these things were proven to have occurred. So what I'm concerned about is the government's supposed to treat everybody fair. The government in our society is civilian led. And so what happens when you have a situation where people are afraid to report police misconduct because somebody might even accuse them of a crime even after they've been abused? So this kind of statute to me would chill the disclosure that we want. And as a police administrator and manager, I would want people to make police allegations of police misconduct because that's the only way you're going to be able to make sure you can protect the department's integrity if you could hear about these things and you could investigate them. I've heard Chief McManus, Chief Olson, chiefs of police for a long time, when people tell them, look, you know, this officer did this to me, they say, well, you know, you got to report it because if it's happening and you don't tell me, then I can't do anything about it. Do we really want a situation where citizens are afraid to report police misconduct? And this could have a very chilling effect. And as far as I'm aware, I haven't heard any numbers about how much money was lost, how any specific case, except for the situation in which Representative Cornish was mentioned, his own personal experience. But for every war story, I got 10 war stories of people who were abused by the police.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Ellison, neither Director Gillespie or I are seeing that there aren't any sustained complaints against police officers. History has shown that there is. What we're trying to do is level the playing field and making sure that those people that abuse the system for retaliation against the police officer receive their due reward. I could go on. Byron McGregor, a man walked in and had mimeographed or photocopied complaint forms from the department and put a stack of them on the bar and put a note beside it. Anybody with a complaint on Officer X, please fill these out. 13 complaints came in and they were all unfounded, but it cost us loads of money. An ad was put in the paper in Evansville, Minnesota for complaints against police officers. Complaints came in, again unfounded, but it cost money. And what we're trying to do is make this an unattractive that you have to pay for it if you knowingly do this with the intent. I think there's a threshold of evidence here that will protect the person if he really believes that the misconduct has occurred. We're not after that person.
Representative Paymar.
Representative Cornish, I'm just trying to understand the bill and the process here. So
on line 19, it talks about, you talked about this sort of high threshold here in terms of proving that someone erroneously reported police misconduct. And it says, knowing that the information is false, would you have to prove this up in court, or would this be something that would happen in internal affairs, individual police department? And how would you prove that the person who made the allegation knew that the information is false?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Paymer, you're correct. You've gotten the crux of it. In a prosecutorial review of this would require to be able to move. The prosecutor would have to, by ethics, know that he has or she has enough evidence to move through to a conviction, or at least a good possibility of conviction. What we're looking at here is that there would a case. These cases will not be so many that they will be proliferative. What we're looking at is a few cases which would have the effect that what we hope for is that people will understand that if you knowingly, with the intention that the officer act on it, make a misstatement against an officer or another person, which is an extremely high threshold in law, to knowing intent. How would you know that? You would have to have some undisputable evidence about what is the state of mind and what actions were taken. In other words, someone else or some other object or corroborating evidence is going to have to support the allegation or support the idea that this is a falsehood. It's very high, and it's very difficult to prove, and we don't expect to be running rampant with prosecutions in this. But we do need this tool.
So, Mr. Chair, I'm still trying to understand how that would work. So, short of a confession that I lied, who would corroborate that kind of...
Mr. Chairman, Representative Paymer, I think you also touched on a second item. When someone does recant, either out of remorse or out of the fact that they are presented with facts that are in conjunction with each other and cannot be true, they do sometimes say they were not kidnapped, as a matter of fact, or that they were not abused physically by the police. And if someone does that, then that would think that would probably be one of the instances when someone would be charged with that.
Final question, Mr. Chair. It seems to me when we heard this bill before, the question arose about a victim of family violence, domestic violence, report by a police officer, a family member, that there might be an unintended consequence to that victim reporting that his or her spouse committed an act of domestic violence for fear that this could be used against them. Do you have any concerns about that?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, only if they knowingly and intentionally lie in order to make the allegation. I'm not sure we want to cover them with the cover of law if they do that act.
Representative Eastland.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think the bill is a good bill. I just have a couple of questions. Some were answered, but part of the punishment is full restitution. And there's been a couple of comments that have been made in the presentation here. Somebody said, well, it's going to cost loads of money, and others said it's going to cost considerable resources to respond to a false lead and all of the things that follow up. What are some of the potential costs that could be assessed against somebody that does something here in the context of full restitution?
I'll defer to
Deputy Chief Johnson. Go ahead.
In our case, it was staff time, some significant interviewing of witnesses and other things, gathering evidence, transcription expenses, all those sorts of things.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Eastland, I can
I guess what I'm asking is not the explanation of what you do. How does it translate into dollars? What are we looking at in terms of what kind of a dollar fine could somebody be facing here as a result of this?
Mr. Chair, Representative Eastland, well, to give you an idea, one of our investigations in the DNR, we spent or the human resources spent $5,000 on a examination of a computer. And in another instance, an investigator hired from the outside so that it wouldn't look like a conflict was another $5,000. So these can add up considerably, and if you figure an investigator's wage between $24 and $30 an hour, sometimes they'll work a week on something like this, because for sure, under the scrutiny that the police officers received today, and Representative Ellison could tell you this, with the Civilian Review Boards and everything else, and everybody wanting to prove that the police officer is either guilty or innocent, hundreds of hours could go into one case, so it can get very expensive.
Mr. Chair, so you're saying it could be like $10,000, like $15,000, or numbers like that, and I guess I don't know. How do other fines for misdemeanors compare to that? I don't know.
Do you have a preference as to...
No, I'll throw it. Anybody that has information on that, I'd be...
Had your hand up. What
the maximum fine for a gross misdemeanor is $3,000. The maximum fine for a misdemeanor is $1,000.
Okay, I guess, Mr. Chair, I guess that begs my question. Then I guess is something here that out of line with what we've got other places in law.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Eastland, in Representative Hillstrom's bill, there was a cap of $4,000 in the bill that does not exist in Representative Cornish's bill. The $4,000 was arrived at by a process that I'm unaware. Perhaps it is the combination of $1,000 and $3,000, but I guess we don't know. But we know that it is in existence in Senate File 622, Senator Mike McGinn's companion bill, so it should probably actually be in this bill also. Although that's not the way it reported out last year when it left this committee, and so I didn't want to put anything in this bill that didn't report out last year with testimony and sent forward.
Wait, just one final comment, Mr. Chair, and this is just a technical thing. On the first page on line 8, it seems like the word false there is redundant. I mean, you refer to the information happening to be knowingly false on the next sentence down there. It just seems like if you provide information knowing that it's false, it just seems to be a redundant word, I guess. It's in the interest of keeping... saving space in our books, but I guess I'd be concerned that we stay consistent and we don't let this fine for this thing get you know outrageously large for what we're classifying the crime as.
Any feedback, gentlemen, ladies?
Would you, Mr. Chair, would you like to make that a motion to strike the first false? Otherwise, if you think it's that much of a problem in semantics or grammar, we could...
Well, I mean, I guess I would make a motion to strike the false on line 8 there.
Line 8, yeah. False, strike that. The author would consider that a friendly amendment and incorporate it in if it's okay at the chair.
All right, currently we have House File 618 as amended before us. Questions? Representative Ellison.
Mr. Chair, thank you for your indulgence. I know I went already once before. I appreciate your... let me ask a question about the first section between page 1, between lines 7 and 9. Say, for instance, an officer comes to my house and knocks on the door and says, "Okay, Ellison, we're looking for your brother. Where is he?" And I say, "I don't know, but I know he's in the basement hiding." Am I guilty? I will have given information to an on-duty officer that I knew wasn't true, and I did want him to rely on it because I didn't want him to come in the house.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Ellison, I think under the scenario you built, yes.
Representative Ellison.
Now, moving down the line 21 and 22, where it says that if I provide information that does not allege a criminal act, for instance, if I said, you know what, that officer called me a blah, 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 fill in the curse word of your choice, but the officer didn't call me the curse word, can I get a misdemeanor for saying that the officer cursed at me when the officer didn't curse at me? I mean, that seems kind of immaterial, but it seems like the law would allow for it.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Ellison, yes.
Okay. Thank you.
Senator Ellison, do you have any more hypotheticals you want to cover?
I can think of a few more, but in the interest of time, maybe after the meeting we can think of them.
Representative Hillstrom and or Cornish, anything further on your bill?
We may want to make
bills.
Mr. Chair, Representative Cornish, I really think that reinserting $4,000 as the maximum amount would be a reasonable request, and I think that that ought to be the direction we take.
Mr. Chair, would the council assist us in one
I'm going to ask Mr. Diebel to offer a few thoughts. Mr. Diebel.
Mr. Chair and members, the way Representative Cornish's bill is drafted, that would be the maximum fine, and as Representative Ellison accurately noted, the maximum fine for a gross misdemeanor is $3,000 and a misdemeanor is $1,000. And so if you wanted to cap the so by establishing the penalties at gross misdemeanor and misdemeanor, you've already established the fine max. If you want to cap the maximum restitution at, say, $3,000, then you could probably just insert a sentence at the end of the paragraph B of subdivision 2 to say that restitution is capped at $3,000. Is that the intent of the authors?
Mr. Chair, remember that it would be fine with me.
Can somebody state what the language is and where it should go? Mr. Diebel.
Mr. Chair and members, I would suggest that on page 2, at the end of line 5, after the period, that you insert a sentence that reads, a restitution award may not exceed $3,000.
Representative Cornish, Representative Hillstrom, did you hear that? Do you understand that? And is that your intent on this bill?
Mm-hmm. Yes, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hillstrom.
If I could just make a comment with respect to that. I really think that that's a good idea, but with the insertion of that language, for example, in the incident in Wisconsin where the girl alleged that she had been abducted and there were hundreds of thousands of dollars of expenses, the maximum amount we are setting then that can be recouped, had that been done here in Minnesota, would be $3,000 or $4,000.
That's the problem you face with that language.
Yes. Just so you know. Full disclosure, Mr. Chair.
Is that language acceptable to Representative Cornish and Representative Hillstrom?
It is with me, Mr. Chair.
Okay, then without any objection, then that language will be incorporated in the bill as amended. Any additional discussion? Any further testimony? All right, then the chair is going to lay the bills over for possible inclusion later on. When we discuss an omnibus bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
All right. Okay. All right. That's it for the agenda committee. Tomorrow we will be meeting and be given an overview of the governor's budget recommendation for the Minnesota court system and the Judicial Standards Board. There's no other further business than this meeting is adjourned. I'm sorry. Hold on. We did the minutes. Meeting's adjourned. Thank you.